Yes, so here we are on 105.5 FM on 123radio.com. Roots on the Air, the Jude Papaloko Show with Samba Jones. And we have here in the studio a poet by the name Aaron. So welcome aboard. Here's Samba Jones. The mic is yours.
Hello and welcome to Roots on the Air. This is Samba Jones and I'm here with Aaron Gilliego. He is also a fellow poet and a student at University of Miami. He's completing his MFA degree, and he's a Filipino-American. And Aaron, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I was born in the Philippines. I grew up there, and I experienced revolution there, the Marcos Revolution, the Cory Aquino Revolution in 1986. And that's really what I've been writing about at the University of Miami, the immigrant experience, the American Dream theme, the post-colonial mentality that Filipinos have as a result of 300 years of Spanish rule and about 100 years of American rule. And that's basically shaped my writing.
So why did you decide to use writing as an outlet to express all of this?
I think that writing, everybody has the ability to write and everybody has something to say. Writing communicates to a lot of people. And the form that I've acquired at the University of Miami is prose poetry, very narrative, which is more accessible to a lot more people.
So do you take that approach when you're teaching high school students as well? You teach high school, right?
I've been teaching high school for 4 years, high school English in North Miami Beach. And I actually, one of my favorite novels is A House on Mango Street by Sandra Cisneros. Mm. And I've really adapted her style in writing my own work.
I love her poetry. Loose woman.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. So what made you decide to continue here in America?
Well, that wasn't by choice. Like most immigrants, I guess, it's the parents who make that decision.
And how old were you?
I was 7 years old. And, you know, my parents did a good job of making sure to provide for 9 children. It was a struggle, and that's really what my work is about, the struggle of achieving the American dream, which is still very much alive for a lot of people.
So did you want to come to America when you were 7?
That I didn't have a choice over. That's a parent decision.
And yeah, is it something that, you know, I mean, was it upheld as some kind of ideal place to visit?
Absolutely. America still has that kind of connotation throughout the world, where people kind of want to go to America to achieve their goals. It still has that connotation throughout the world, and it is the ideal place to achieve dreams.
And do you remember when you were 7 if you actually like felt these dreams were fulfilled when you actually came here? Was it a disappointment?
It was very much like the moment in House on Mango Street where Esperanza sees her house and she's like, that's it, that's where I live. And it was like a kind of unfulfilled promise. But I'm realizing all those dreams now in terms of what my parents did, in terms of my accomplishments that I've been able to do as a result of that move.
Well, I think the beauty of your writing also is you do maintain that connection culturally to the Philippines, and you intertwine the diaspora to your experience here in America as well. Did you want to start with a piece?
Yes, I would love to read a few pieces. The first one is called Remote Control. The first time Papa loved me was when he bought me a remote control car, unsolicited. He returned from America and brought it back as pasalubong, a gift for those left behind. You give pasalubong because you feel guilty others could not come, or to reassure them that you were thinking about them while you were away. Mama got oil of olay. The cost, $20. My aunt was given the Betamax. In Tagalog, the word for love is mahal, which also means expensive. That's probably why we think love has a cost. When Papa came home, he showed me how much he loved me. My brother wanted that remote control car, but I got it because Papa loved me more that day. Mark next door had one that my brother and I coveted. If only I could take the remote, then I could steal the rest at night when Mark was asleep and maneuver the car straight to my room. I had schemed for days until Papa came home with a remote control car for me. Only, this one had the remote attached by a wire. So when I pressed down on the control pad, I had to take steps back, the same way Mama controlled Papa on a leash. Whenever he left to go abroad, she'd have to follow him. That was the only way to keep him under control. When I compared Mark's remote control car to mine, I knew mine did not look right. It was not Mahal. So I cut the wire the way Papa cut my umbilical cord after Mama's stomach opened up like a gift.
Wow. Mahal. That's a beautiful word.
I'll read another one called Corned Beef. And I think this is something that a lot of people can relate to. A Balikbayan box arrives, which means for the next 2 months, we eat imported goods. Imported means important, or not for the maids. Auntie Gailey always said imported with her hand on her hip as she sprayed a mist with her supercilious peas. Whenever guests arrived, "See that lamp? Imported yan," she would say, nodding toward the peas. Whenever the maids cleaned and she didn't want them to touch important things, "Don't touch that vase, ha? Imported yan." Whenever she cooked and asked me about her cooking, "Doesn't that taste masarap, ha? Imported yan." And I would force the food down even though I didn't like it. Maria hands me 2 cans of corned beef and shows me how to open it using the key, putting the metal tab through the key slit and then winding like a clock. I always ask to be the one to open these cans. Makes me feel like I'm opening a gift. The hams and luncheon meat are opened the same way. They're imported. I wonder why these meats are so precious they have to be locked up and guarded with a key. Auntie Gailey takes all the keys off from her cans, throws them all out except for one she keeps under a pillow. That's how she guards the imported things in life.
Wow, nice. What I love about your piece is that there's so many specifics to your particular cultural experience, but at the same time, there's this underlying feeling that everybody can relate to, that feeling of wanting to be something else or understanding the foreign.
Absolutely. And poverty is something that still is very pervasive in the Philippines, and it's something that the reason for immigration for in a lot of places, it's poverty. It's trying to get out of that situation. But one thing that really protected me as a child is that childhood innocence where I was fascinated by the most simple things. I didn't realize at 7 years old or at 6 years old that there was actually a revolution taking place in the Philippines. I felt like that kid in Life is Beautiful in the Italian film by Benigni. Mm. You know, I didn't know what a tank meant on the street. I was just fascinated by the tank. I'll read, I guess, one more piece.
We can do a couple more.
Or a couple more. This one is definitely a post-colonial poem. It talks about the guitar, and guitar is one of the biggest exports of the Philippines. It's called Jonah and the Guitar. In the dim-lit basement, he takes the guitar Mama had brought from Cebu. He doesn't know that its body is made of camagong, a dark, mysterious wood that Katipuneros used against the Spanish. When he strums the guitar, the battle cries resound, indigenous and indignant for nation, for soul. He improvises the A and E strings with fishing wire, a kind of Pinoy ingenuity, atavistic and archetypal. He tightens the tuning keys and the fishing line becomes taut as nylon strings. Thumb index middle ring, he repeats to himself as he practices strumming with his right hand, learning a ballad that troubadours long ago had sung during conquests. Parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme. Parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme. Mother of pearl eyes dot the fretboard. They tell him where to put his left hand to make the chords. What they don't tell him is why they are opaque. The bleary eyes of a mother in mourning, hiding the shame of a nation's rape.
Wow.
And the other
one... Wait, I want to talk about your writing.
Okay, go ahead.
I love your method of weaving so many intricate details in such beautiful language that's so easy to understand. And you tell the story so directly, but at the same time, there are a lot of different links to the colonialism, to your life experience as a child experiencing these different things, to the music itself, and even that song that you chose. I mean, you explained a little bit about
yes.
the dual meaning to it.
Absolutely. Well, that song has been around since the Middle Ages, and I kind of imagine it's made famous by Simon and Garfunkel, of course, but it's been around since the Middle Ages. I had just imagined when I was writing it, when I did some research, that this could have been sung by those conquerors. It's a very classic, traditional song from the Middle Ages, English ballad.
And even the instrument itself is tarnished with the symbols of the colonists.
Absolutely. Mother of Pearl is a big export of the Philippines. The guitar is made in Cebu. a lot of guitars are. And it's something that I grew up with. We always had a guitar in the family, in the house. I know how to play just basic chords, but my brother is a musician as well.
And as we're going to continue on after the interview, I mean, music is something that I think definitely ties all people together, and it's a resounding universal language that everyone can relate to and experience that. So are you going to read another piece?
Yes. This one has definitely to do with language and how language is part of the colonialism. And at a young age, we had to practice English. And so this one is called Maria Ban's Tagalog. You have to pinch your nose so that it's not pango. Pango means flat-nosed. Pangit means ugly. You want to be guapo with a nose that's mestizo, one that is shaped a perfect triangle like the Mayon volcano. The other kind of nose, the nose that the maids have, is pangit. You see how ugly they are with their noses, flat and provincial like the hills of Bohol. Hold it for a minute, even if it hurts. Every night you have to do this, especially if you want to go to America. And you will be going soon. But if your nose is not ready, you will be left here with the ugly people. In the meantime, you must practice your English. You must practice while you hold your nose. So no more Tagalog. English, English na lang.
Wow, that's a powerful piece.
And it also the image, self-image that Filipinos have in the Philippines is one that is shaped by media and the American influence, the Western influence, and the kind of the fact that you don't feel like the aesthetic of your own people is can be held up as the ideal beauty is tragic.
And the way that it's written within the story, I mean, it's told straight. And you can tell the simplicity of a child's mind doesn't question whether or not it's something appropriate to do. They just take it at face value and say, okay, you know, I have to change my appearance in order to fit in.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It definitely has tragic consequences. And I wrote that piece after Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eyes, which had a resonance to me when I read that novel in the ninth grade. I'm like, wow, that speaks to me. The tragedy of wanting to be something, a kind of beauty that you can never be. And I've written about it before in article form.
Beautiful. Do you have another piece for us?
Sure. Should this be the last one?
Good to you.
This is part of my manuscript that I finished. It's called In the Neighborhood of Madness, the whole manuscript. And I'm actually presenting it at Books and Books on Wednesday morning from 11 to 12.
Yay!
The whole manuscript is done.
Congratulations.
And this is the last piece in the first part of the manuscript. It's called Born Bulan Sorsogon. Bulan is the hometown where I was born. Bulan means the moon. It must have been low tide. The sea smell, brine, and dry remains of shellfish on sand left behind by offshore waves blew into the window of the clinic. It calmed Mama down. It got on Papa's nerves. Papa ran the only clinic in Bulan, built on property where my grandfather owned and ran a store until it burned. The kapitbahay said the land would be cursed. The clinic would get people sick instead of heal them. But they had no choice. Papa was the only doctor in town. When the luya didn't fix sprains, when the bawang didn't get rid of toothaches, they would line up at the clinic for aspirin and then run back to pray. The week I was born, Mama made sure to avoid sitting near doorways and staircases. She made sure to take off all her jewelry. She made sure not to sleep with damp hair. For 9 months, I was fed mangoes with shrimp paste. That's supposed to make me smart and strong, though the kapitbahay thought that was supposed to make me hairy if I turned out to be a girl. Low tide is good luck. The moon isn't sucking up the energy of the world. That's when I decided to arrive in Bulan.
Beautiful. Thank you, Aaron.
No, thank you, Joan.
Okay.
Well, I can speak about sort of the other politics that are involved in this book. There's definitely, I write about Imelda Marcos and her shoes, which apparently is what the Philippines is known for. I talk a lot about immigration and that the impact on families and diaspora, splitting people up. I talk about the fact that the jobs that are available for, you know, for the most part, a lot of people in my family are nurses. It's a practical thing to do. they're recruited from the Philippines, nursing. And basically the book was inspired by my father's death 2 years ago. And then my mom, it's a tribute to my mom and the strength that she has as this really, really powerful archetypal mother. It's very strong, kept the family together, and she was very inspiring. So I hope that my mom is proud of that book if it ever gets published.
I'm sure she is. I mean, you have a very universal tone to the way you write, and there are words and messages that I think everyone should listen, should be able to hear. You know, I mean, I hope you get published all over the place.
One of these days. That's definitely the goal. But I love teaching. Teaching is something that gives back to the community, the students. It's very inspiring. I think one of these days, you know, everybody should take a shot at teaching because it really teaches them about themselves, and it's very powerful a position in society.
And do you encourage the students also to write about their personal experiences?
Well, that's a challenge at the high school level in terms of sometimes you can't let them write what they want. But certainly, I always, when the students are empowered to write about their own selves and empowered to write about experiences that they could never articulate in other ways, you see a light bulb go on and you see that, wow, writing has power. Writing has power for people. It has power to heal. And it has really a cathartic effect for themselves.
Mm, definitely. Healing through the words. Music does it also. But, I mean, when you're writing, do you realize that you're going to touch so many people through what you do, or do you just write it for yourself?
No, I write it for myself. I write about issues that I am passionate about. I write about, most of my stuff is autobiographical, and that's something about poetry is that there is no nonfiction poetry. Poetry is poetry, whether it be the epic of Homer to the very personal journals of Emily Dickinson. Poetry is all-encompassing, but there's something called what's the imagined truth in poetry. It's always going to be true, regardless of whether or not I make it up or, you know, based on a historical fact. There's a truth to it that resonates with people, and that's the power of poetry. And that's really why I chose that form to write in. And I can put it on the paper and people can say, hey, that's a poem. And they're not going to judge me as the person. They're not going to judge the individual behind that page. It's always just going to be about the poetry itself, the craft, the language, the sounds, and the meaning.
Absolutely. The mental landscape, at least for me, is just intertwines with reality and fantasy so much that if I actually had to decipher the two, I don't think I'd be able to do it as well. So,
Aaron, I have you trigger something in me when you said imaginary true. Mm-hmm. If it's imaginary, how can it be true?
Well, it's called the imagined truth. And
imagined truth.
Yes, that there's still a fundamental truth in our imagination. There has to be. It's grounded in what we've experienced. It's grounded in sort of the archetypes that Carl Jung talked about that are implanted in our mind. Our imagination is a manifestation of all that we've taken in. So even if you imagine something, there's going to be truth to it. It's going to be based on lived or perhaps kind of subconscious experience.
I mean, I don't think there's anything that's completely objective. Maybe there are, I mean, I definitely believe there are universal truths that are carved in stone, as a wise woman told me. But other than that, everything is based on our subjective experience at that time. I mean, our emotions, our past experience, our past lives for that matter. I mean, everything, the adrenaline that's coursing through our bodies, what we ate for breakfast is all going to obscure how we actually witness that experience. And so we can rewrite our history. We can create the future. I mean, it's all based on our own. I mean, there we get into quantum physics, and I mean, it's limitless possibilities. It's just based on which one you want to choose at that one given moment, what you can actually comprehend at that one moment.
Yeah, I love what's going on here because, you know, they're carved in stone, but then, you know, the stone itself is not true. It's turned to dust any given moment. And if you tell me there's a fundamental truth that is carved in the heart of every being, of every human being, and every being, and every creation, I tend to go for that more than, because, you know, for imagination, you got to use the mind. And all the experiences, like you mentioned, mostly by the time we've grown up, you know, everything comes from the eyes opening and the ears opening to the outside world, you know. But then there is a greater truth that is embedded in the heart of each one.
Absolutely.
Even before birth, you know, in the mother's womb, that truth was already there, the truth of life, the truth of creation.
Absolutely.
The truth of that power that puts all this together. And maybe you can call that power the greatest imagination, because it takes an amazing imagination to create this whole planet and to create then each human being a little different than the other and yet make them all alike.
Absolutely.
I think it's amazing imagination.
A thought is a seed.
A thought is a seed. Yeah. But beyond this imagination of the Creator, I see that there is a substance, there is a reality that we can call truth that is really... We can find it. Each one can find it, you know. It can be true. One thing that can be true to all of us, or else it's not going to be true. It's relative true. But I think this arena of expression through poetry, and go to this soil of imagination, it's just fantastic, because it's exploring, you know. In a way, we're exploring something greater than us.
Yes.
And just trying to smell it out and feel it out and bring it home, you know?
Making sense of it all.
Making sense of it all.
Like, I told my family that this is my perception of what happened. You know, this is all, to me, this is all true. It captures the truth of what happened. But I was 5 years old. A lot of the memories that I write about was when I was five, a long time ago. And it, you know, it doesn't try to say that this is, you know, this is exactly how it happened, but it captures the essence of what happened, and there's a lot of truth to it. But again, it's a mind's perception of that moment in time.
But then what about the truth of that which didn't happen? Or then go to the truth of that which is happening. You know, there is something that is happening that is beyond description.
Absolutely.
Beyond the writing, beyond the expression.
But that's the burden of the writer, is to be able to capture all of that, to make sense of the world around us, to make sense of the atmosphere, and to make sure that it can be communicated in language that people can understand and say, wow, that is true, and I can relate, and I understand what's being said.
So how do you relate, I'm just very curious, to poets such as Rumi or Kabir or Khalil Gibran, William Blake, that they come from an arena?
Well, they are definitely speaking to their contemporary audience and capturing the context that is around them through powerful language and powerful imagery. And there's still truth in Blake. There's a lot of truth in every poet I've ever come across. There's so much truth.
Well, that's the beauty of the poetic playground. I mean, you put in your entire conscious, subconscious, whatever's going on at the time that you decide to put on the page, but it's such a loose, like I said, playground that another mind can enter into it and take and choose, you know, what they want to get out of that. It's not like it's something that is doctrinated, you know. I mean, every person can take their own opinion, their own viewpoint, and get something else out of the same piece.
Yeah, that's the beauty of it, probably.
Absolutely. It's very similar. Music, all of art has the same kind of resonance with people. People will go to it with their own lives and own experiences and perspectives, but take something away. And the artist has done something magical and powerful, communicate something to that person, that audience. That's really an incredible moment. It's a great moment.
It is. Even this moment is incredible and great. And if you be so kind, remind the listeners where they are. And
okay.
This plug it in.
Roots on the Air, 105.5 FM, and on the internet at 123radio.com. And we're here with Yaron. I'm Samba Joan. We're speaking with Aaron Gallego. And, of course, this is Jude Papaloco's show.